Every business has an ambition. PayPal Open is the platform designed to help you grow into yours. With business loans so you can expand and access to hundreds of millions of PayPal customers worldwide. And your customers can pay all the ways they want. With PayPal, Venmo, Pay Later, and all major cards. So you can focus on scaling up. When it's time to get growing, there's one platform for all business. PayPal Open. Grow today at paypalopen.com. Loans subject to approval in available locations.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now. And support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
The Financial Times guides you through complex issues. In divisive times, don't settle for black and white. When you need the full perspective, turn to FT.com. Become a subscriber today. Search for FT subscription.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast, episode 821. It's the 7th of July, 2017. On the podcast today, I have Rob Proctor, CEO of Audioboom. That's Boom ticker there. And Rob discusses their newly launched monthly subscription service for podcast creators and also talks about general progress at the business. Plus, Graham Lumsden, CEO of Motif Bio, MTFB, talks about the significance of their recent announcement in that three abstracts have been accepted for poster presentations at the Infectious Disease Week in San Diego from the 4th to the 8th of October. Also on the podcast, Russ Mould, Investment Director at Stockbroker AJ Bell, talks about the following stocks: Cortex, that's QTX, James Latham, LTHM, and Marlowe, MRL. And by the way, today I think Russ does bring the feeling of British summer to the podcast, because Russ is reporting live from his daughter's sports day. Yeah, it's nice, very nice feeling about it. Also on the podcast, as is a Friday, Simon French, Chief Economist at Panmure Gordon, talking about UK industrial output, a bit of a surprise drop today, house prices not looking very bullish, the EU signing a free trade deal with Japan. So they've done it, why can't we do it? And he also covers non-farm payrolls. Plus, as always, top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. I cover those. And the top five most liked RNSs on the platform in the last 24 hours too.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Rob Proctor, CEO of Audioboom. Ticker there is Boom. Rob, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, no worries. How you doing, Justin?
I'm good, thanks, yes. And I still remember last time now, you sort of laughed when I asked you to introduce, for people not aware of you, what Audioboom is all about. But listen, there's new, as you know with podcasting, new people listen all the time. So there may be new investors who are just you know, starting their foray into the investing world, and they've sort of heard of you. They're not quite sure how you make money. So, Rob, for me, for people, not for me, but for people not aware of how you make money, how do you do it? How does Audioboom work?
Yep, no, absolutely. So, I mean, at our basis, we're a technology platform company that allows podcast creators and audio creators to kind of upload, store, syndicate, and then monetize that digital audio. Mm-hmm. So we are a technology company at heart, but actually the driver of our business is we're a media sales company, so pre and post roll advertising on those podcasts, and obviously the very high value in-read or host-read advertising that gets created by the podcasters. They're making the podcast, so they deliver the message. And I think more and more we are becoming more of a podcast creative company as well. Obviously, things like Atletico Mints and working with No Such Thing as a Fish Team and Undisclosed and you know, the lawyers behind Serial and everything in the US. So, you know, we're a media sales company using technology and now creating content, because obviously content we create, we own 100% of that, so it's got a much bigger gross margin on there. So again, as part of our overall revenue mix, having that element that's now growing rapidly on the platform, I mean, is massively useful for us moving forward.
Yeah. Okay, let's go into some of the updates you've had of late. Let's go back. I'll do it chronologically, so I'll go back furthest away. So in the second quarter update, we haven't spoken to you since the final results. So second quarter update, revenue, you said, for the 6 months ended 31st of May would be at least 1.8 million, which is good going, considering I think that's more than last year, isn't it? But I mean, but in the final results, previously,
a lot more than last year.
Yeah, exactly. And in the previous results, you said over £3 million of advertising campaigns and now booked occurred during 2017 financial year. And I think some people were confused by those two updates because one is obviously a lot bigger than the other one. So I assume the rest is booked in the next half of the year, is it?
Yeah, so at that point, you know, we had a little over 3 million booked. We delivered 1.8 in H1, mm-hmm. giving us another 1.2 million was already pre-booked for Q3 and Q4. Obviously, you know, but we're taking bookings all the time. In order to get through, we've got 5.4 million in the market. You know, I think last time I was on, I said we were really happy with the number that was in the market and the work that that David Johnson had done at L&B, the analyst there, and, you know, the guys at Liberum before that, around the methodology on the numbers, and looking at our forward bookings and where we're going through this quarter and into Q4. You know, certainly nothing has changed to make me... To change my mind on my comfort on those numbers that are in the market. So you know, good from that point of view. And I would guess the latest PwC report on the podcast advertising industry that we'll hopefully have up on our Vox profile later on today. You know, it's shown a 19% increase quarter on quarter for podcast advertising. I think you can see from, you know, our Q4 and Q1 and then Q2, H1 results, our quarterly growth is a lot more than 19%. So we're outperforming the other podcast companies in the market, and we're certainly growing aggressively compared to everybody else in our market. So again, really happy from that point of view. Did kind of, you know, getting the job done, and we know the numbers we have to hit by the end of the year.
Yeah, excellent stuff. Okay, the most recent bit of news, you announced the launch of a monthly subscription service for podcast creators. Now, when I read this, I thought, I just thought, people are aware the podcast space is hot. There's probably a lot of people starting up podcasts every day. And I thought, it's just for, and taking up your service space, essentially. I thought it was a way of stopping these people do that or charging them for it. Now, but is there more to it than this, Rob?
I think there is more to it for us, actually, as a company. So, you know, we've obviously been around, you know, 3.5-4 years in our format that we run now, being that platform to creators rather than being purely a consumer platform. And we've got a lot of podcast creators on the platform. And I guess in broad strokes, you could go, okay, you know, we've got the tier one guys like Astonishing Legends or Up and Vanished at 800 to a million listens an episode. Mm-hmm. And then we've got the guys that are just starting out or what have you, or they're kind of hobbyists and whatnot, that are down at, you know, 500 or 1,000 listens an episode. Mm-hmm. And we run every gamut in between. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, as a company, we run an ad-supported model, revenue model. So obviously the tier one guys and tier two guys, tier two being 60 to 80 to 100,000 listens an episode, those guys are relatively easy to monetize. You know, it's, they've got brand, the advertisers know who they are, it gives them reach, the opportunity cost of buying is lower because we can aggregate them together. It's all good at that end in terms of our overall model and our overall growth margins. where we've got kind of that long tail of smaller podcasters, you know, some of it's really good content, it's very valid, and they obviously want to do it, and we get it, and we love having the functionality and the content to deliver to the consumer, so that's all good. But on our model, it is harder to monetize those guys for that high value in-read, host-read advertising. But the account management cost to us, the time and energy and resources we have to spend on the smaller podcasts, is probably just as much as we spend on some of our bigger podcasts. So, you know, obviously, in very broad terms, our gross margin on those, where advertising is harder to sell, the rates are probably less, yet our cost of running them is pretty much the same. So to keep supporting those people with our great functionality and scalability in our network is important. But as a company, we have to realize that we need to do something at least to balance the books on that long tail, if not make a lot of profit. So by bringing in this $9.99 a month charge for the smaller podcasts, it gives them the opportunity to stay with us, to use our functionality and our distribution, but allows us to balance the books.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing it does, there are some podcasters that, for whatever reason, don't want to take advertising. And we get that. It's their content. It's their product. Fully understand that. Not a problem. But again, as a business, we can't provide those people, for whatever reason, you don't want advertising, with a free service and free bandwidth and free support and all of that good stuff. So again, it allows us to keep working with those people, but allows us to balance our books moving forward.
Yeah, okay, marvelous stuff. And at the moment, like you just said previously, you are quite comfortable with that, you know, 5.4 million revenue target for the year being in place. So the hot areas, I'm assuming, where you monetize or get the best return now is in-reads and also creating your own podcast. Is that right?
Well, certainly in-reads are of the moment in our industry. You know, the sell-through rates are very good. Our fill rates are climbing on that. But as well as the fill rate for campaigns sold climbing, actually what we charge per 1,000 adverts is also going up. So that's working really well. We obviously do revenue share the money we make from that back with the podcaster. So we have a pretty fixed GM around that. We're making our own podcasts help for us. We produce them. They're ours. We own them. So we, in effect, are creating our own IP. It can't go anywhere else. After cost of production, and the average podcast, let's say, costs $300 to make, we retain 100% of the revenue after that. So obviously the gross margin on that is better. So as we increase the amount of our owned and operated content as a percentage of our overall revenue mix, then our gross margin will grow through this year and certainly through 18 as well. So we see that as the evolution of the business. The programmatic side of the business, I mean, our available inventory is going through the roof at the moment. It's going really well. As we put out in the results, I mean, everybody can see our available ad impressions are up, you know, double if not triple digits over the last three or four quarters. And we can see again, you know, and all your listeners will be able to see when we post this PwC report, that especially in the US, fill rates for programmatic audio are also going up. So whilst there's always a lag between, you know, agency intention to buy actually buying and, you know, 120 days for the agencies to pay, we can see those fill rates moving forward on programmatic. So whilst it's true to say right now, host-read advertising, high value, high yield, really performing well in the market, we can see that programmatic is coming. So that platform that we've built, the diversity of content we have, the amazing distribution we have off our platform to Twitter and Facebook and Spotify and all those other places that generate more and more programmatic inventory, we can see the market for buying that slowly picking up at this point. In the UK, it's picking up much quicker in the US. So, you know, dominated by in-read at the moment, but programmatic probably is going to be the big revenue story out through, you know, H2 18 into 19, and that mix will change from host rep to programmatic. But again, we're well placed because it's what our platform was built to do in the first place, in order to take advantage of that. Short term, we're very focused on the host rep advertising, where the high fill rates and the high yield are at the moment.
Yeah, okay. And one final question. You know, you're pretty much, I suppose, your focus, or where you monetize best is in the US or in the UK. But are there any other areas now you're looking at and expanding in and think there's a lot of potential in?
Yeah, I think, you know, we have great relationships with, you know, certain services. Again, we've not announced it to the market yet. One of them is a big service in France. They've done a good job of pulling all of the podcasters together in France. Unfortunately, their model is all about subscription. So the podcaster gets, you know, fractions of a penny per play. But our partner needs the podcasters actually to do much better because they want more podcast content on their platform. So our partners have asked us to, you know, potentially look at France. Mm-hmm. Pick up those relationships with all of those established podcasters and just go in and sell the in-red advertising. So to go in really as a commercial-only operation, and we sell in-red advertising through the French media industry for established French podcasts. So we'll be looking at that probably into Q4, so the start of Q4 once we get the holiday silly season out the way. So I can see that. Will it have an impact in 17? No, it won't. Will it have an impact in 18 if we execute properly? Yes, it should. So I think Europe is definitely a focus for us. You know, we scaled back in Australia and in India in terms of headcount, although our inventory and our sales are going better in those countries as the markets pick up. The high touch, you know, areas of focus for us for business are the US, there's no doubt. UK is moving forward well, and we'll be looking at European opportunities over the next year to 2 years.
Marvellous. Well, Rob, the final thing you need to do is people are listening to this and they like the sound of this, but they're not following you yet on Vox Markets. Can you give them three reasons why they should hit that follow button, please, on your page?
So, I mean, like I say, we're going to try and post the PwC report later on to our Vox profile. We've also just completed a massive survey of the Audio Boom user base, actually carried out by Edison, so completely independent. We'll try and post that on the Vox profile later on today as well. Anybody reading the PwC report on the growth of the podcast industry and advertising, and then reads Audio Boom's user survey and the stats and the data that's come off the back of that, put those two things together, and you can see one where the industry is going hugely right now, but also what Audio Boom has built in terms of quality of product, quality of users, and the engagement around that advertising leads us to know that we're in a booming space with the right product, foundations in place, with a growing user base. Normally for both businesses, you put those together, that's going to be a formula for success. So it's only one reason, but it's a long reason. There you go, Justin.
Marvellous. Rob, good to chat to you, and hopefully speak again soon. Thanks very much.
Brilliant. Thank you, Justin. Your stuff.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Graham Lumsden, Chief Executive Officer of Motif Bio. That's MTFB. Graham, thanks for joining me again.
You're welcome, Justin.
And I know full well you're at a very interesting stage in your journey here. And for people listening right now who are not aware of what you're all about, and we're going to the news you've just released, but for people not aware of what you do and where you are at the moment, could you give me a summary as to what this is all about, your journey, please, Graham?
Absolutely. So Motif Bio is a biotech company with a novel antibiotic candidate called Iclaprim. And we announced in April of this year the top-line results from the first of two Phase 3 trials. Phase 3 is the final stage in clinical testing. And Iclaprim looked great in the first Phase 3 trial that we announced in April. Great efficacy, great safety data. And the second trial, because the regulators have asked us to do two trials, the second trial, which is identical to the first, just different clinical trial sites, is on track for top-line data to be read out later this year. So we're bang on track as to what we've previously disclosed. We should be able to submit what's called a new drug application, or NDA, to the FDA for approval in the US in the first quarter of next year, 2018. And because the FDA has granted Iclaprim as what's called a qualified infectious disease product, we expect a decision rather quickly from the FDA, quicker than usual. This is something specific to antibiotics. So we expect a decision, obviously, hopefully an approval, before the end of next year, 2018, and we would be ready to commercialize very shortly thereafter in 2019. So a late-stage biotech opportunity, novel antibiotic candidate called Iclaprim, very well differentiated with advantages and benefits over current standard of care antibiotics.
Yeah, so not long left. And like you said, I think when I first started looking at it, studied you and started researching your company, when I sort of looked at the Revive 1 and Revive 2, and you realise, hang on, they're exactly the same apart from the geographics, is that right? So just in different areas. So you'd think it's highly probable that your results will sort of be closely mirrored in Revive 2. Isn't that the case?
Well, the fact that we've got top-line results from Revive 1, I think, significantly de-risks Revive 2, because you're absolutely correct. They're identical protocols, same inclusion-exclusion criteria for patients who are involved in the trials, just different clinical trial sites. And that's at the recommendation of both the FDA and the European regulator. They just want to see two well-controlled trials, and so that's what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's get to some news you just released. So Motive Bio to present three posters at ID Week 2017. Can you explain what this is all about? Because I started reading about it and I thought, yeah, it looks good. But so what is Infectious Disease Week, and what does it mean for you?
Yeah, so Infectious Disease Week is one of the important scientific gatherings of the year. There's usually over 6,000 infectious disease specialists, healthcare professionals who attend this conference. It's in San Diego in October. And we had previously announced a couple of weeks ago that our chief medical officer, Dr. David Huang, had been invited by the organizers of this conference, ID Week, to present during one of the symposia sessions about Iclaprim. So that's a pretty prestigious invitation. We're delighted that David will be presenting on Iclaprim. What we've announced today is that in addition to that, the scientific committee has accepted three abstracts that we had submitted that we want to present during Infectious Disease Week in October. And they confirmed that they've accepted these three abstracts. The first one is what we were just talking about, is a poster presentation of the data, the top-line data from Revive 1. But we think the other two abstracts that have been accepted for poster presentation could be particularly interesting to the scientific community. The first one is a study where we looked at Iclaprim and its effect on something called exotoxins. Exotoxins is a fancy name for poisons, mm-hmm. which are produced by the bacteria, including MRSA, methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. And this is associated with some pretty nasty infections. One of them is called necrotizing fasciitis, or more often described as flesh-eating bacteria. Mm-hmm. These are these nasty cases where you hear about patients in hospital who end up having to have limbs amputated because of these so-called flesh-eating bacteria that eat away at the skin and the underlying tissue and the muscle. It's actually a misnomer. They're not bacteria that's eating the flesh. It's these exotoxins or poisons. And so the interesting thing here is, in abstract number two, Iclaprim was studied and shown that not only does it kill the bacteria, but it also decreases significantly the production of these exotoxins or poisons by the bacteria. Now, what's important about this is that we've been positioning Iclaprim as particularly suitable, we think, once it's approved, for the seriously ill, difficult-to-treat patients in hospital, including, in this case, those who have these nasty MRSA bugs producing exotoxins or poisons. So this is very important. This is what we call a differentiator. This is one of the advantages or benefits that Iclaprim has compared to many other antibiotics. And so we think that's very important scientifically.
Yeah. And there's a third point you also is, which is quite interesting as well, isn't it?
Yeah, so the third abstract that's been accepted is an animal model which mimics what happens in patients with cystic fibrosis. And of course, cystic fibrosis is a genetic disorder. It's classified as an orphan disease because there are fewer than 200,000 patients in the US, and there's similar figures in Europe. And often what happens in patients with cystic fibrosis is they quite frequently suffer from lung infections. And the reason for that is one of the most significant problems with patients with cystic fibrosis is they get this sticky mucus buildup inside their lungs. It's difficult for them to breathe. It's difficult for them to get rid of bacteria. And so they're very susceptible to nasty pneumonias. And in fact, about 80% of patients with cystic fibrosis end up dying as a result of a lung infection or a bacterial pneumonia. So this is an important disease for us to study with Iclaprim because we've already shown that Iclaprim concentrates dramatically in lung tissue. And we've also shown in a small phase 2 trial in patients with hospital-acquired bacterial pneumonia that Iclaprim seems to work very well in patients with pneumonia. So what we've done in this experiment that's described in abstract number 3 is we've looked at a recognized animal model. We didn't want to go straight to patients with cystic fibrosis because it's literally a life or death situation. We wanted to have some evidence that Iclaprim could be helpful in patients with cystic fibrosis. And so this animal model mimics what happens inside the lungs of patients with cystic fibrosis. And so this was an important first step for us to show that Iclaprim actually is very effective. And therefore, we can embark on a development program to look at patients with cystic fibrosis who get nasty bacterial lung infections or pneumonias and to determine whether Iclaprim is actually a good fit for these patients with cystic fibrosis.
Excellent stuff. So I assume, well, I've done, obviously I know nothing about Infectious Disease Week, but it's obviously quite a prestigious event, and I suppose, like you said, the who's who of this community will be there. So what do you hope to achieve by presenting there, Graham?
Yeah, so it's recognised as one of the top conferences of the year. Mm-hmm. So it's important for us to continue to build awareness and recognition of who Motif Bio is and what we're bringing forward with the development of Iclaprim. And it's important for the attendees of Infectious Disease Week that they get an opportunity to see in poster form some of these differentiating aspects of Iclaprim, as well as listen to Dr. David Wong, our Chief Medical Officer, who will be presenting during a symposium. So it's a perfect fit for us to be at the right conference in October of this year, continuing to build the awareness and knowledge around Motif Bio and Iclaprim.
Excellent. Well, listen, sticking with the theme of three, Graham, all I need from you is three reasons why. If someone's listening to this right now and they're not following you, three reasons why, they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets, please.
Yeah, I think, first of all, we read almost on a daily basis that there's this urgent need for novel antibiotics because the antibiotics that we currently have available, particularly in a hospital setting, are just not working in enough bacteria anymore. And we're continuing to see problems with multi-drug resistant bacteria where patients have run out of antibiotic options that work. So at Motif Bio, we have a late-stage antibiotic candidate called Iclaprim. We expect a decision, of course, hopefully an approval, in next year, 2018. And so I think it's a very great example of a late-stage biotech opportunity for somebody who'd like to invest in and participate in the antibiotic space. Secondly, we're dual-listed both on AIM and on NASDAQ. That gives us access to a great team of very sophisticated research analysts, both in the US and the UK, a large pool of capital, life science specialist investors who are interested in stories like we have at Motif Bio. And lastly, I think the fact that we announced the top line results from our first phase 3 trial in April, showing excellent efficacy and safety data, and the Revive 2, the second trial coming later this year, it's a great opportunity to invest when we've already seen the top line first phase 3 trial results that look really, 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 really good. So I think it's a pretty interesting opportunity compared to many other biotech life science investment opportunities.
Yeah, absolutely. It's probably worth saying, actually. I mean, is it, you know, to point out the potential of this drug, you know, going forward, Graham?
Yep. Well, there's two. We're aiming squarely at those difficult to treat, seriously ill patients who have to be hospitalized because of these infections. So we're not interested in, you know, people with sore throats who go to the doctor's office and get pills. This is a hospitalized situation where the patient requires an intravenous antibiotic, and that's exactly what we have with our antibiotic candidate, Iclaprim. And so two recent precedents, I think, are important. One is an antibiotic that was called daptomycin, trade name was Cubicin, from the company Cubist. They launched into the hospital space with their antibiotic for skin infections, mm-hmm. and then built additional indications thereafter, and ended up with peak year revenues of about $1.4 billion. And the second recent example is Pfizer, who had an antibiotic called linezolid, or Zyvox was the trade name. And again, they launched into the hospital setting with a skin indication, so efficacy against patients with nasty skin infections. And then they followed up with a second indication in hospital-acquired bacterial pneumonia. And again, Pfizer's Zyvox ended up with peak year sales of about $1.3 billion. So we're trying to mimic what these two success stories did in the recent past. And we're well on the way with top line data looking great from our Revive 1 phase 3 trial.
Excellent, Graham. Good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll speak again in the not too distant future. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Russ Mould, Investment Director at stockbroker AJ Bell. Russ, how are you doing? You're all right?
I'm really well, mate. How are you?
Good, thanks. I can sense a nice change to the normal background there. I can sense the sound of an English summer somewhere.
Yes, you've got a very keen sense of hearing. I'm actually sat at my daughter's sports day with Dean Stadium in Brighton. Spot nice. Football fans will know it from where the because that's where Brighton Hove Albion used to play. It's mm-hmm. council-owned track and stadium until they moved to the Amex 4 or 5 years ago. So I'm actually just watching the second round of the 800 metres go around. There's one young lass who was off like a bat out of hell. Wow. She must be 50 yards in front of the poor lass who's showing good commitment at the back and is hammering rounds. So
Has she paced herself, though? What did you say? Is it 1,500 metres?
It's 800. We'll find out. She's just coming into the straight now, so we'll find out on the second lap. But at the moment, she's well and away, but the lass in second, who's also wearing a red jersey, so I can't distinguish him between them that well, is keeping a steady pace, so it'll be interesting to see. Yeah, we've got two blues, orange, purple, and purple. So there we go. That's my David Coleman-style commentary.
Yeah, well, in this weather, in this heat, you know, you could, you know, sort of puff yourself out before the first lap.
I don't envy them, I tell you. There's lots of water sloshing around at the finishing post, thankfully, so.
Right, before we get into the stocks, how's your daughter been doing so far?
Third in the 400 metres, which she'll be absolutely delighted, stayed on very gamely, and then fifth in the 100, which isn't her strongest event, and she's got her best event coming up, she's throwing the rounders ball. She's got a strong arm. So
I don't know why they dropped that one from the Olympics, that throwing the rounders ball. I really like that.
Maybe we should campaign for it to be brought back.
I know. Okay, let's go into stocks then. Russ, what are you looking at?
So we've got three that we've all looked at before. There's been a bit of news on all of them, so I thought we'd do a review. We'll have a look at Quartics, James Latham, and Marlowe, all AIM quoted.
Right, Quartics, what's all that about, then again?
So Quartics is a GPS telematics system company. Obviously, that's got a bit of a stigma attached to it because of what happened at Quindel or whatever that became. And there is another company called TrackMate, which operates in a similar area, which we'll actually touch upon. So Quartics provides this system to help out with insurance, for fleets, trucks, vans, and things like that. Oh, there you go, there's the commentary. And the lady who was in front led all the way around. But what it doesn't do, which is makes it very different from Quindel and actually different from TrackMate, is that it doesn't provide the kit to the insurers, it provides it to the fleet operators. So there's a slightly different angle there. And actually, the company is in the midst of a transition, because it used to do its business with insurers, and it's decided that's actually thin margin business, it's too competitive, so it's going to go down the fleet route. And that's actually why you've seen earnings per share growth slow down a little bit in the year that's just finished, and analysts are actually predicting a drop for the year that's just begun. But we've had a trading update for the first half, and it was in line with expectations. New installations up more than 40% overall. The UK was up more than 40%. French installations tripled, and the US was up around 60%. New installations, that is. So it's all going according to plan. Insurance is down to about a third of the business, and again, that seems to be helping margins.
Yeah.
So pretty much steady as she goes. Now, we first looked at the stock in May, and frankly, the stock's done nothing since then. It's bobbled around between 380 and 400p. It's in a bit of a holding pattern. What isn't helping probably is TrackMate coughed up a profit warning in February and published full year results also in the past 10 days, and the stock's gone from a quid to 80p. Revenue's up 4%. Pre-tax profit down nearly 3/4, where they said that, you know, that they've just had some delayed contracts with the insurers, which have been very competitive, and the stock's been hit. So we've got two companies that operate in the same area. It's clearly a coming area. It's key. It helps people with their insurance claims. It helps insurers keep a track of what's going on. Hopefully helps keep premiums down. But two diametrically opposing strategies, and we're going to be finding out in the next year or so which one's going to work best. But at the moment, at least, Quartix, you could argue, perhaps he's having the better of the arguments.
Yeah, definitely. I know, but surprisingly, I think TrackMate is more popular amongst private investors. But we'll see who wins the.
I mean, Quartix is very profitable. I mean, it's making £6 to £8 million for the year ahead on revenues of £24 million. It pays a yield of more than 3%, which obviously isn't that common in small caps. I guess the one knock on it is on a pretty beefy earnings multiple, mid-20s, low-30s, with what could be this transitional year coming up of an earnings drop as the sales mix begins to change around. So we'll see what happens. I guess the next 12 months are going to be pretty telling.
Yeah. So Quartix is around about 183 million market cap. Just looking at TrackMate here. TrackMate's about, it's a tiddler. It's under 30 now, 30 million market
cap. It is now. It's had a really torrid year if you look at the charts.
Okay, what's next, Russ?
So James Latham, which is a different type of business altogether, it's a timber merchant based in Hemel Hempstead. It's been quoted for 10, 15 years now, about a similar cap, 170 million. And we looked at this one first in May, and it's actually, again, not done an awful lot, to be honest with you. It sort of bobbled around the 850p mark. But again, you'd like to think it's in a pretty decent area. Timber merchant building, you know, we've had some good construction PMI numbers this week, and you've obviously seen some good reassuring numbers from house builders like Barclay, like Persimmon, like Bovis recently. It's one of these family-run companies. It's not going to do anything daft. It's got a net cash balance sheet. It's been around for a long time. It's going to be around for a long time. And they had full year numbers actually in late June, just when I was horsing around at Royal Ascot. So it's just worth checking up on them. Revenue's up 7%, operating profit up 8%. The one slight drag was earnings per share was only up 4% because of increased pension deficit contributions. So there's a net cash on the balance sheet of 16.5 million quid, but the pension deficit is 16.5 million quid. So there's no danger to the balance sheet, but it is holding back earnings a little bit. They said that they're off to a decent start for the full year with revenues up 2%. The one thing to watch, they are talking about a little bit of gross margin pressure because a lot of their raw materials are imported and the pound's gone down, so their costs have gone up. It's on about 16, 17 times forward earnings, yield of around 2%. I think it's probably one, you know, the momentum is okay. The valuation is okay, but it's one of these well-run family companies that's not doing anything daft and therefore is probably a relatively steady holding, unless, of course, you think Governor Mark Carney is going to jack up interest rates and completely puncture the UK housing cycle, in which case, you know, you'd probably fight shy. But even if he is talking a good game on interest rates, I guess we'll have to see it when believe it when we see it, I suppose.
Yeah, but I think any rise obviously will be slow and gradual.
I think that's very, very good way. I think even Ian McCafferty, who's one of the hawks on the Monetary Policy Committee, is talking about a couple of rate rises at a very moderate pace in the FT today, isn't he? So I think that's right. Yeah, I don't think it's going to happen overnight.
Yeah. Okay. All right. And the last one, Russ.
Marlow, which since we looked at it in June, has gone like a rocket. It's gone from just near 3.10 to just under £4. only floated about a year and a half ago. It's got 110, 120 million market cap, and it's just published maiden full year numbers where it made a 0.7 million pre-tax profit. It's also announced a small bolt-on acquisition, and this one's worth flagging, A, because it's met its numbers. It's done everything that it said it would as a public company, which is great. It's not always easy for small caps to do. It's a big change, step up the management teams. The other thing is just remind people what it does. It's a provider of fire and water services like alarm systems, sprinklers and fire extinguishers, which obviously for all the wrong reasons has been very much in the news recently. Yeah. So it does show that, you know, and just looking at their numbers, clearly there are people out there taking this seriously because they're buying lots of their kit. And it looks, I would imagine, over the next 12 months, again, unfortunately for all the wrong reasons, they may well be buying an awful lot more of its kit. So let's see what happens. Certainly, and it deals with commercial businesses, it deals with local authorities. So I guess there's a possibility they're going to be busy people, and they're also looking for some small bolt-on acquisitions as well in fire and in water, and they found already. So we'll see what they come up with, and it's already paying a small yield. Again, if there's a knock on it, there is some of the good news priced in. It's trading at about 20 odd times forward earnings, so you're gonna have to be patient, but the momentum does look to be pretty strong right now.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, I didn't actually take, you know, ever think of a commercial angle on that Grenfell Tower, you know, disaster.
Yeah,
but do you know what? When you think about they've identified 600 blocks around the country, and if they haven't got sprinkler systems in, there's a lot of pressure now, isn't it, to get these systems in.
So
you've got to say that this company could benefit,
It reminds me of another company, Halma, which I'm not sure is necessarily involved in fire and water, but it's definitely, and that's a FTSE 250 company, but that's definitely involved in things like life safety, hazard detection systems, you know, things, just little things like checks that things like the elevator doesn't go from the top floor to the basement of the department store in one swoop, doing some serious damage to the elevator or anybody who happens to be in it. And so these kind of companies, they've got a regulatory driver where the legislation has already been passed, can have a very, very consistent and strong base to their business, and it can give them a little bit of pricing power on the revenue and maintenance as well.
Marvellous. Russ, enjoy the rest of the sports. It's quite official. You've got the announcer and everything there. It's quite official.
There's even a lap counter and all sorts. I'm most impressed with the organisation.
At my son's sports day, I was actually filming his sprint, and they gave this sort of medal to this one kid. And because I'd videoed it, I just wanted to look back at my son's style and technique and see where he went a bit wrong. And I noticed the guy they gave the award to didn't win. So what's going on here?
I
wasn't going to mention it, but I did. And do you know what? It really has stirred up a couple of problems there.
It has.
And
no,
I wish I hadn't.
Competitive dad, clearly.
I know. Anyway, Russ, thanks for that. Speak
Pleasure.
Next week.
Look forward to it. Have a great weekend.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Simon French, Chief Economist at Panmure Gordon. You all right, Si?
Justin, very well. Yourself?
Yeah, not too bad. Now, as we're recording, literally, we've just started there. We have some news out, so we'll get straight to it. Obviously, people can listen to podcasts whenever they want, so we don't know how hot for them this is. But so we had some news on industrial output in the UK. Is that right?
That's right. So, I mean, whenever you look at this, actually, it's relevant because let's give you the headlines. So the index of production, which is the amount of both manufacturing and energy production, oil production the UK produces, down 1.2% over the last 3 months. And the market was looking for an increase. I think why it's relevant any time you listen to the podcast over the next few days is that this is key for the Bank of England when they're considering whether to raise interest rates. They think that as the UK economy and the consumer slows, that industry will pick up the slack with investment and exports. If they're wrong, an industry can't pick up the slack, and certainly this data suggests it's not doing a great job at the moment, then of course the likelihood of the bank raising interest rates anytime soon is much reduced.
Yeah, well, that's quite a drop, isn't it? 1.2% over 3 months, isn't that quite a drop?
Well, I will caution that there's a lot of stuff in here which can be quite lumpy. And by that, I mean there's a lot of... we had a big drop in industrial production, for example, last year when one of the big North Sea oil rigs closed down for maintenance.
Now,
if you then read across and suggest that that is in some way cyclical of activity in the UK economy, then you're drawing the false conclusion. I think the counterbalance to what is a fairly negative bit of data is the fact that order books volumes... are near their 20-year high. And, you know, there are mixed pictures around how UK manufacturing is doing and how well it's benefiting from a weaker pound. But I have to say that this just adds to the slightly softer amount of data that we've had thus far in July, covering the sort of the core part of quarter two, which is, of course, follows up on a weak quarter one when UK GDP growth just was 0.2%.
Yeah, okay. Well, I suppose there's a surprise that they thought it was going to expand, but it contracted. That's the big shock, I suppose, isn't it, really?
That's right.
Okay, let's look at, you were mentioning house prices, which don't seem to be very bullish at the moment.
Well, it's of course, it's a UK institution to talk about house prices. Let's stick to the data. So house prices across the UK up 2.6% last year. Now, that's quite a slow rate of inflation based on what we've seen really since 2010-11, when the current bout of house price inflation started kicking off. And the quarterly picture is more bearish still. It was down 1%, and this is from the Halifax. If you look at new buyer inquiries, which is the best leading indicator, it suggests there will be some more short-term weakness. Again, important to disentangle this story because it's not purely an economic story in terms of, you know, generated on appetite for consuming houses. A lot of this is tax related. A lot of this, both for buy-to-let landlords and for high-value home buyers in the UK and the southeast of London. They're being hit by a raft of tax rises that have come in over the last 2 to 3 years. And there is an element of perhaps consumers sitting on the sidelines waiting until perhaps the tax burden is reduced before they get back into the market. So you're seeing as a result a bit of a weakness in house prices, with surveyors reporting very, very little in terms of volume of transactions.
Okay, marvellous stuff, yes. And it's saying here that the average house price now is around about £218,390, which I know in some parts of the North East you probably think that's a very expensive house. In London, you can't pick anything up for that. You can't get a one-bed flat for that, pretty much, can you?
Well, you have to go into some perhaps less salubrious parts of London to pick up anything of that price. I mean, the I wouldn't ever focus on the nominal amount of values. What is important for most people, most of your listeners, will be the ratio between house prices and average incomes. And across the country, it's about 5.5 times income, which already looks stretched because most mortgage providers will only provide you, let's say, 4.5 times income. But if you come down to London and try and buy down here, then it's about 10 to 11 times income. Now, clearly, if you are a first-time buyer looking for an opportunity in that market, you have to have an enormous deposit. And this is why, at a time when real incomes are also coming under pressure, we've got poor wage data from recent months, it does seem a very difficult environment on which to transact, get on the ladder, and indeed move up the ladder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you know what? Talking about, obviously, we have to mention Brexit, pretty much every macro story regarding UK. Mm. But so yesterday, I think it was yesterday, there was an EU board, one of the main guys, I think, was saying that the UK can't expect frictionless trade deals. And then I read with interest today that Japan and the EU now have come together to do a tariff-free trade deal, or it looks like.
Yep, and this is Michel Barnier, so the European Commission's lead negotiator, was in a speech, spoke about the unrealistic nature of having frictionless trade. And I think there are two parts to the Japan-EU story. The first one on tariffs is good news for the UK, and let's not lose sight of that, which is that the appetite to do free trade deals between countries, between economic areas, seems, despite the Trump rhetoric behind it, despite the Brexit rhetoric behind the broadly protectionist rhetoric, they still seem to be able to be done. That's good news for Liam Fox, who's going to be charged with going out and signing these trade deals. The point that I think Barnier is making, which I do have some sympathy, is when he talks about frictionless trades, he means some quite boring stuff, but very material stuff for exporters, like rules of origin, like the equivalence of standards, the kind of stuff that wasn't encompassed within the Japan-EU trade deal, which is more about tariffs, but much more about the slightly softer non-tariff barriers to trade, which still will exist between Japan and the European Union. So I think there's a little bit of subtlety within that message that doesn't make it plain sailing for the UK as it seeks the big prize, and I do think it's a big prize, to try and get the speed of transmission of imports and exports through Dover, through Heathrow, through our major airports and ports into the European Union. That's going to be tough to do outside the customs union.
Okay. And we did mention earlier, obviously, podcasts can be listened to at any time, but I know everyone sort of tries to guess non-farm payrolls in America. They're out at 130 today. What's the thoughts, Si? What's the forecast?
Well, given it's the podcast, we, you know, people will be accessing at a different time, let's not focus too much on the guess. The guess is around 170,000 additional jobs, wages at about 0.3% month on month, 2.5% year on year. But if it comes in higher or comes in lower, I think the main takeaway for investors is that the Federal Reserve are looking to instigate a third rate rise this year, either at the September or the December meeting. And they're also looking to reduce their balance sheet. $4.5 trillion is the size of the Federal Reserve balance sheet. What they're going to try and do is look for positive data from the labor market to indicate that they can do that kind of putting on the handbrake and the footbrake at the same time, so interest rates and reduction in balance sheet, because the labor market is strong enough. Clearly, if we do get a softer picture regarding the US labor market, that might add a bit of caution and lead to the Federal Reserve just choosing one of those two break options.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, marvellous stuff. And do you know what? I'd love to be a fly on the wall today in Putin and Trump's meet, would you? Because he was quite... I don't understand Trump. He really had a go at Russia, didn't he, in front of the, in the public. If I was Putin, Trump seems to me like a bit of a bully boy, you know? If I was Putin, first time I shaking his hand today, I said, by the way, I don't appreciate you, you know, bad-mouthing me in front of the entire world press. I don't appreciate that at all. And really, because he's a judo guy, isn't he? Get him down the floor. It's judo versus wrestling, you know? And Trump's into wrestling and Putin does judo. So I think judo will win out here.
Justin, you've given a great idea for somebody to go on YouTube and play around with that wrestling clip that he did with CNN, but put Vladimir Putin's face on. I think that probably is... It's first person that will already be on YouTube. You're right insofar as, you know, there was talk, wasn't there, of Putin and Trump being friends, and now they seem less than friends, or certainly if you look at that Poland. But I think you need to be mindful that Poland and Russia are historically not well, so have been great friends. I think he was perhaps playing to the Polish gallery by saying something quite negative about Russia. I think he may also be playing to a different gallery at the G20, particularly given the importance of the sort of strategic relationship between between the US, between Russia, and also bring China into the mix in terms of the big geopolitical players.
Yeah, he was playing the gallery, but doesn't he understand that it's broadcast, you know, internationally? It's not just a home crowd looking at him, domestic crowd. It's, you know, people around the world are looking at what he says. He's the president.
Maybe Justin, you're just looking for consistency where you shouldn't be looking for consistency.
Exactly. No. Yeah, there's no consistency in the mind of a madman, is there?
He's rewritten the rules, hasn't he? And it's quite possible, and people who know the guy much better than you and I say that he takes his inspiration from the last thing he read or the last thing he was briefed about. And perhaps the State Department got some quite negative briefing to him about Russia. Mm. And he went, right, today I'm going to be... maybe he reads something else tomorrow and he'll be best buddies again. I mean, who's to know? The rules just simply don't apply.
Yeah, well, listen, if World War III hasn't started by the weekend, so we'll have a nice weekend and hopefully we'll speak next week.
Cheers, Justin. Looking forward to it. Bye-bye.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 3 hours. They were at 5, 7 Digital, that's 7DIG. At 4, Talao Energy, TLOU. At last, it's broken through. I've been covering that for a while, you know, the chart on that stock for a while. And I said yesterday was the fifth time it attempted to break through resistance. But looking at the RSI, Relative Strength Index, it looked very promising because it was, every time it tried to break through before, the RSI didn't go above 60. Now, when I reported it yesterday, it was at 65. I said, last time it's done this, it did break out. And it did break out. I'm no genius. I'm just reading the chart. That's all. And if you look at a chart, and you know, for long enough, you'll find sort of certain things, for certain indicators, give it away. But it broke yesterday, and it's breaking again today, above around about 10% up as well today. Okay, at three, Angus Energy, ANGS. At two, New Orleans Gas, that's NUOG. Our number one most followed company on the Vox Markets podcast is UK Oil and Gas. It's not the most followed on the podcast, don't know what I'm saying there. On the website, on the app, that's UK Oil and Gas. Okay, top five most liked RNSs on the platform in the last 24 hours were: at four, Highland Natural Resources. It's a finance agreement for East Denver. I don't know why Denver always reminds me of John Denver. My mother used to love John Denver. And didn't he die in a plane crash? I mean, his own plane. But, yeah, some cracking too. The Annie song was cracking. Anyway. Clear Leisure, CLP. Final results was the most liked number four. Fourth was liked. At three, Ascent Resources, AST, issue of equity. At two, UK Oil and Gas. That was drilling update at Broadford Bridge. And number one as well was the UK Oil and Gas flow test consent, Broadford Bridge. So two there of the top five. Top two is from UK Oil and Gas. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
The Financial Times guides you through complex issues. In divisive times, don't settle for black and white. When you need the full perspective, turn to FT.com. Become a subscriber today. Search for FT subscription.
Every business has an ambition. PayPal Open is the platform designed to help you grow into yours. With business loans so you can expand and access to hundreds of millions of PayPal customers worldwide. And your customers can pay all the ways they want. With PayPal, Venmo, Pay Later, and all major cards, so you can focus on scaling up. When it's time to get growing, there's one platform for all business. PayPal Open. Grow today at paypalopen.com. Loans subject to approval in available locations.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.